Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Hemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas, and I'm with the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast, and I'm here at the 37th Annual East Scientific Assembly. I'm talking to Dr. Jason Smith after his presidential address. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for your words. Thank you for your leadership. Your address was relatable and inspiring and heartfelt. So thank you. So if you could look at your presidential year from a 30,000 foot view, how would you describe it? Did it meet your expectations? How do you feel?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words. You know, I will tell you that the president giving an address like that is very different from giving a grand rounds or an educational talk. And so you're always a little worried about how it lands. But I appreciate the kind words. It's always good to have positive feedback after something like that. This year's been fantastic. It's, as I said in the talk, it's a culmination a bit of a lot of years. And you look at it as being, oh, this is your president year. It means so much. But when you really think about it, I'll be honest, it was a time I spent on the research committee or reviewing on publications committee or when we were doing InvestSee or any of the number of projects that I've got a chance to do. That's the real meat of what this is. And so that's been so much fun. But, you know, the president's year, it's fantastic. Representing the organization, you get to travel a bit. You get to give a few talks and wear your East pin and get the name out there. It's a lot of fun.
Awesome. A significant portion of your address was about gun violence as you shared the atrocities that you experienced in your community with the mass casualty shooting on April 10th of 2023. And you mentioned that we as trauma surgeons are actually perfectly positioned to start having and be a part of these gun violence prevention conversations. It was sort of a call to action for us to really get into this. What advice would you give for surgeons looking to get involved in gun violence prevention and advocacy specifically?
Yeah, so the first thing I would tell you is there are so many great members of East that have a lot of knowledge, about what it means for gun violence and like what you can do to try and intervene or how you can begin those discussions. And I mentioned a few of them today in that talk, but it's one, the great part about East is, you know, come and see us, say hi, pick up the phone, text somebody out of the blue. We love to have those conversations and talk. I think that's the first step because there's a lot of information out there. It's super useful for you to have them. As the other thing, you know, I said, it's about a call to action. It's take that opportunity. You know, they happen. And I will tell you, I'm probably not the best person to talk, but when the opportunity presents itself, be a person to begin that discussion. And if I can cheerlead anybody on to do that, I think it's worth doing.
Awesome. And then our final question, do you have any words of wisdom for our learners, our residents, our fellows looking to join our field and be the versatile sporks that you alluded to during your talk? Any words of wisdom for them?
Well, I think if you're going to go into this field, you're going to have a lot of caps to wear and a lot of duties to do. And I think from our perspective, it's part and parcel to what we have. We have a little bit of an attention deficit problem at times, right? As trauma surgeons.
Absolutely.
And it fits right into our personalities to be able to do that. So from our perspective, I think, you know, embrace it. Take those chances. Be present at the meetings. And by be present, I mean, talk to people and come say hi and introduce yourself. And we're a big organization. You may have to introduce yourself a couple of times, but we'll get to know you. You'll get to know us. And it leads to just an outstanding career.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Right. Now that the speech is over, I absolutely will.
Hell yeah. Take care.
This is Samantha Terrace. I'm here at the 2024 East Annual Meeting. Our first session of the meeting is the Raymond Alexander Resident Paper Competition, and I'm with one of our presenters. And I will let him introduce himself. It's paper number 3 on pre-hospital end-tidal CO2 predicts hyperfibrinolysis in injured patients, implications for early use of antifibrinolytics in trauma.
My name's TJ Shade. I'm a current clinical third year at the University of Colorado in Denver. Going to be applying to trauma and acute care surgery fellowships in a few short years, and I was just really excited to get on here at EAST. This is my first EAST, and so just really excited and honored to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your research, your project, and the conclusions you guys came up with.
Yeah, so this project is focused on pre-hospital monitoring of end-tidal carbon dioxide. And our lab has done previous studies where we show that pre-hospital end-tidal carbon dioxide is really, it's a good predictor of massive transfusion and mortality in injured patients. But we had never looked at what about trauma-induced coagulopathy, and specifically hyperfibrinolysis, which is the most lethal of the phenotypes of trauma-induced coagulopathy. And so what we ended up doing is using a lot of that data, and our endpoint being trauma-induced hyperfibrinolysis as defined by citrated rapid tag on ED arrival. And we found that pre-hospital end-tidal carbon dioxide was also a strong predictor and a better predictor than systolic blood pressure and shock index of hyperfibrinolysis on ED arrival. And as it was what we suspected in, with massive transfusion and mortality, it has to do with end-tidal CO2 being a sensitive marker of hemorrhagic shock, of the shock physiology in severely injured patients.
Did you guys come up with any, like a number that us as clinicians might be able to use in the future for this?
Yeah, with our analysis, we use the Uden index to determine sort of optimal cutoffs for a test among all patients, regardless of pre-hospital blood pressure, so just the general population. We found that lowest pre-hospital end-tidal CO2 of 22 or lower was associated with the strongest predictability of hyperfibrinolysis. In that analysis, while the positive predictive value was only just under 10%, we know that hyperfibrinolysis is extremely rare when considering all patients. And so it actually, using that test, more than triples the pretest probability, meaning you start to use other variables to inform your decision-making about whether or not to give antifibrinolytics or how likely this patient has hyperfibrinolysis. This test is very good. Then when we look at hypotensive patients who are at a higher likelihood of being in hyperfibrinolysis on arrival, that positive predictive value jumps to 27% at a lower end-tidal CO2 cutoff of 17 or lower. So we're talking pretty low pre-hospital end-tidal CO2s, but from the data that we have here, it's pretty promising evidence.
Any limitations to your guys' study?
Yeah, and something we touched on in the presentation, one big limitation is the numbers. This lethal phenotype of trauma-induced coagulopathy is rare, fortunately, but we only had 8 patients with hyperfibrinolysis among the whole group analysis when we used our fibrinolysis or LY30 cutoff of 7.6%. And then among the hypotensive group, we had only, I believe, 12 or 9 patients. And so it's a small number of patients. And so I think we need to study this in a larger cohort to really be able to make definitive conclusions. But from the analysis we've done, it's very promising and deserves further study.
And what do you think the future, like if someone comes in with this low number, they're hypotensive, what are you going to do in the trauma bay?
Yeah, we've talked about we need to study this further. It's very promising. And this particular study is focusing on using antifibrinolytics for hyperfibrinolysis. There's data that's coming out that suggests there are some other uses for antifibrinolytics, protective to the endothelium, other anti-inflammatory properties. But for the purposes of specifically this coagulopathic phenotype, we think that this could, with larger data, inform the decision-making about whether or not to give antifibrinolytics to prevent excessive clot breakdown in severely injured patients.
Well, this sounds all very promising, and we look forward to the future research coming out of you guys. Thank you again for your time. Is this your first EAST meeting?
This is, yes.
Are you enjoying it so far?
Oh, it's been a blast so far, and I'm excited.
Thank you for your time.
Hello, this is Melissa Warte. I'm from the EAST Educational Resources Committee here with TraumaCast, and I'm speaking with Dr. Amanda Witt, who just gave a wonderful presentation during the resident paper presentations. I'd like to have her introduce herself to all of you.
Hi, my name is Amanda Woody. I'm a current research resident at the Children's Wisconsin campus and a general surgery resident at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee.
Wonderful. Welcome to East, and I hope this is going to be one of many of your return visits. And I just would like you to tell us a little bit about your paper and how you got involved in pediatric VTE research.
So this was a multi-institutional study done through the Midwest Pediatric Surgery Consortium. We had done several smaller studies at our institution previously looking at high-risk criteria in deciding which pediatric patients needed VTE prophylaxis. And so this study was an offshoot of that. And we are interested in this because there is a lot of perceptions in pediatric care about who is at high risk for VTE, and there's a lot of concerns still about increased risk of bleeding for patients who receive prophylaxis.
Very true, as I think many of us have the same struggles in many of our institutions with the pediatric population and trying to figure out who do you really need to push for that prophylaxis and who do you not. A couple of things that struck me is we didn't really talk much in your paper about where the central lines were located, which was one of your major risk factors, and also what type of prophylaxis was used when pharmacologic prophylaxis was used, and what are your thoughts on those two variables?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great follow-up questions. Our central venous line distribution was fairly equal in patients who develop DVT between the neck and the femoral site. Again, these are small numbers. We also are looking more into the duration of the lines and the size of the lines and if that was appropriate for the patient in some of our further work. In regards to your second question,
the type of prophylaxis, heparin versus Lovenox, et cetera.
Yeah, thank you. So we recommended that all patients receive Lovenox as the type of prophylaxis, but still included patients who did receive heparin, saying that it was a very small number, less than 5% of the patients received. Certain patients may have been on therapeutic anticoagulation for vascular injuries as well, and we did include those patients in this study.
Excellent. So at the end of the day, what is your hopeful take-home message for everyone who listened to your talk today?
One of the most significant findings in our study was that VTE prophylaxis was safe in this high-risk population when you take appropriate delays for intracranial hemorrhage and other ongoing hemorrhage. So I think the hesitation to give prophylaxis to these critically ill patients should hopefully be less from the results of our work.
Excellent. Well, I personally very much enjoyed the talk, and I'm sure everyone else did as well. And I wish you best of luck on the paper competition.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Samantha Terrace here at East with another one of our resident presenters that presented not only once, but actually twice as she was helping cover for a colleague of her. So I will let her introduce herself, and then we will go into her two presentations that she presented here.
Hi, I'm Lauren Gallagher. I'm one of the research residents at the University of Colorado. I'm in Dr. Cohen's trauma lab there, and we have a great group.
It was great meeting you. Going to just discuss the first one that you presented, which was cytoprotective APC and FFP as therapies for endotheliopathy of trauma, separate or in combination. If you can just give us like a quick summary of this, again, as most basic scientists or basic science research, us as the clinicians always want to know what's the real world application for this one down the line.
So we're all very familiar with this endotheliopathy of trauma that kind of manifests as this like systemic thromboinflammation. And we're always looking for targeted therapies in order to help mitigate this effect. And our mainstay of treatment has been using resuscitative plasma, but we've started evaluating this drug that was previously used in the treatment of severe sepsis, but was taken off the market because of severe bleeding complications, that has been bioengineered to retain only about 5% of its bleeding complication and remain all of its cytoprotective effects. And that's called 3K3A-APC. And so we're interested in the cytoprotective effects of this drug and how it can be used in therapeutics of trauma. So what we did was we compared our mainstay of treatment, our resuscitative plasma, to our 3K3A APC. And what we found was that 3K3A 3K3A APC actually mitigates the effects of the endotheliopathy of trauma to a better extent than resuscitated plasma alone.
Very interesting. And I think in your presentation, you guys applied the drug preemptively to the trauma. Is there future work in looking at this post-trauma, as that's how most of our patients show up?
Yeah, ideally what we'd like to do is be able to bioengineer this into maybe an EpiPen that you can deliver in the trauma bay to our patients so they do have that cytoprotective effect in that prevents them from the late stages of morbidity and mortality we see in our trauma patients, or even do it in a vaccine to our deploying military and be able to give it to them before they ship out and protect them from the injuries that we see in our military population of trauma patients as well.
Very cool. This sounds like very exciting research and definitely has a lot of applications. Now, this was work done by one of your colleagues, so we should give him some credit and tell him where is he that he's not here at the meeting this week.
Yeah. Dr. Thieling's done a remarkable work on this project, and I'm lucky that I was able to look like I played a little part in it, but he really did all the work on it, and I was just here for the show. He just welcomed his firstborn daughter, Charlotte, into the world, and she is adorable, and she's all cheeks, and she's so cute, and I can't wait to...
So let's talk about your other presentation. So this was Smoking Primes the Metabolic Response in Trauma. Tell us about this study and what your findings were from it.
Yeah, we're really fortunate at the University of Colorado to have this multi-omics core. And we work with some of the worldwide leaders in metabolomics and proteomics, Dr. Dale Alessandro and Dr. Hansen. And what we're able to do is do this rapid identification of all these different mediators in the context of any type of comorbidity and in the global concept of trauma as well. So we wanted to look at a potential biomarker, cotinine, which is a metabolite of nicotine, and be able to assess that in the setting of non-smoking, passive smoking, and active smoking, if there were differences in a biological effect, not only in our control populations, as a healthy control population, but also in our high injury, high shock trauma patients.
And what did you guys find?
So it's interesting that in our control population, we found that they had this upregulation of this oxidative stress response and these chronic inflammatory pathways. So it really seems like that smoking just contributes to this overall systemic pro-inflammation and response to oxidative stress that primes you for your next hit. And in our trauma population, what we found was this mitochondrial dysfunction, this dysregulation of a lot of these electron source proteins, these TCA cycles, glucose metabolism. So evident that this is really truly having an effect on our trauma patients and something we need to consider in future resuscitation.
Excellent. As always, it's a lot of the basic science research that really drives a lot of what's the future of trauma and where things are going to be happening. So again, congratulations on your work. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa Warte, and I'm here on behalf of the Educational Resource Committee in TraumaCast with Dr. Rachel Sharon from Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, who just presented at the scientific papers that should change your practice. Rachel, would you like to introduce yourself to the group?
Hi, thanks so much for having me here. I'm Rachel Sharon. Like you said, I'm an assistant professor of surgery at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Awesome. Well, this was a really informative session, and I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about how you got involved in being one of the presenters in the discussant for this session, and a little bit about how you chose the paper that you were involved in.
Well, I've been lucky enough to serve on the Manuscript and Literature Review Committee under Dr. Bilal Joseph, and it was really just a question of volunteering and being able to put your name in the hat to present for this session.
Great. Well, you gave us a lot to think about in terms of your paper, but of the papers that were presented, which one do you think was actually the most practice-altering?
You know, I think it's really interesting because the three papers are all relevant for different reasons. The emergency general surgery paper we chose was based on artificial intelligence just because that's a new topic for our field. And so I think it's more about what the future could hold for that. And just the surgical critical care paper was fascinating because I think it's something we all live through routinely. When we're intubating patients and they get transiently hypotensive, do you give a fluid bolus? How's that going to affect your patient? But I got to select one of the trauma paper, which is the PATCH study. And we looked through the top articles from Journal of Trauma and then across multiple different journals for the year. And I think it's really interesting because a lot of people are already using pre-hospital TXA. And this was a study that, again, showed survival benefit in the first 24 hours. And so to me, I think that is either practice confirming or maybe practice changing for some people.
Great. So I'm guessing that maybe the take home is pre-hospital TXA should be your new best friend.
I think for some people it will be. And as you could hear, there was some healthy debate. So for me, I think it's a lot about patient selection. And then I think the dosage question is still of interest. So I think that initial bolus dose, what the exact right number is, we're not sure. But I think within the 2 to 3 hour mark of injury is the right time for that.
That's excellent. And again, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us and to be part of the scientific assembly. As always, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, this is Mohammed Bawazir. We just finished an exciting session about scientific papers that should change your practice. I have here with me Dr. Sineha Bhatt, who presented a paper about the effect of fluid bolus administration on cardiovascular collapse among critically ill patients undergoing tracheal intubation, a randomized clinical trial. Thank you, Dr. Bhatt, for being with us today. Can you please summarize the study for us?
Sure. So the PREPARE-2 trial essentially looked at the effects of a IV fluid bolus on critically ill adults undergoing tracheal intubation. And so it was a multi-center parallel group unblinded randomized controlled trial that took place across 11 different ICUs across the United States between February 2019 through May of 2021. It compared the administration of a 500cc fluid bolus versus no fluid bolus preemptively for critically ill adults who were undergoing tracheal intubation. They looked at adult patients essentially who were receiving both medications to induce anesthesia and those who were undergoing positive pressure ventilation with either bag mask ventilation or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, aka BiPAP, CPAP, etc., between the induction of anesthesia and the laryngoscopy. And it's interesting because when you look at the results of PREPARE, they found that there was no difference with the IV fluid bolus group, but when they did a subset analysis in that prior randomized control trial, they did see that there was potential benefit in those patients that were undergoing positive pressure ventilation. So PREPARE 2, this study really wanted to focus on that group that was potentially receiving some positive pressure ventilation. So the patients were randomized 1-to-1 in those groups of either receiving a 500cc crystalloid infusion of choice versus those that did not, unless it was for treatment of hypotension or it was deemed necessary for patient safety. And the primary outcome was looking at cardiovascular collapse. And then the secondary outcome was looking at incidence of death prior to day 28. They had about 500 patients in each group and did a decent job of kind of risk stratifying, making sure that the two groups were relatively equally matched. What they found was that there was essentially no statistically significant difference in cardiovascular collapse in these two patient groups. They also did not find a statistically significant difference in death during that time frame. And they also found that the PaO2, FiO2, and PEEP at 24 hours after intubation did not differ between the two groups. So essentially, that 500cc bolus does not seem to make a statistically significant difference even in these patients that are receiving positive pressure ventilation based on the study.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. Because this session is about changing the practice. So tomorrow, when you see a patient who's being intubated and becomes hypotensive, are you going to give fluid or are you going to give vasopressors?
I think that's a great question. And for me, I would not be bolusing a patient solely for hypotension in these situations, or I wouldn't be preemptively bolusing a patient, rather. I think it's still a particular situation, and sometimes patients are already maybe intravascularly deplete and need a bolus for other reasons. And I think obviously you still have to interpret the data to the particular patient. But in terms of a preemptive fluid bolus, I personally do not and will not be doing that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Mohammed Bawazir. Now we just finished the session about scientific papers that should change your practice. And I have with me Dr. Caleb Butts, who presented a very interesting article about artificial intelligence versus surgeon gestalt in predicting risk of emergency general surgery. Thank you for your time, Dr. Butts. Can you please summarize the paper for us?
Yeah, so this was a paper where they looked at 150 patients retrospectively from a quaternary hospital in New England, and they created a standardized patient presentation that was fed into the Potter system as well as given to surgeons to estimate the risk. In addition, there was another group of surgeons that received the Potter risk assessment and then were asked to give their own risk assessment. And basically what we found is that surgeons tend to overestimate risk, that looking at all five of the outcomes that they used, which included mortality, septic shock, ventilator dependence for greater than 48 hours, bleeding, requiring transfusion, and pneumonia, that in all five of those outcomes, surgeons tended to overestimate risk with a risk assessment that tended to skew to the right. When that same number was fed into Potter, we saw actually that the plurality of patients were somewhere between 0 and 5% for all five of the outcomes. But surgeons, the plurality tended to be somewhere around 5 to 15%. When that same data was provided to a separate group of surgeons and they were asked to give their risk assessment, the skew to the right decreased between the two groups of surgeons, but didn't totally correct it. When they looked at actual accuracy, there was no statistical difference between the two groups. And so basically what they found was that while surgeons tend to overestimate risk, while the Potter group tended to be not statistically better than surgeons or surgeons with Potter.
I have also here Dr. Sneha Bhatt, who is the discussant of this paper. Can you please discuss the paper?
I think the biggest takeaway that we have to look at is, at the end of the day, these were case reports that were reviewed by surgeons and then by the AI model. And when you have the same case report data going in and out, whether it's an AI model versus a human, obviously the AI model wins, but there's a lot to be said about the actual bedside assessment of a patient, the potential discussions that occur between patients, patient families, et cetera. And there's a lot that maybe doesn't go into that decision-making tree. So that's something that's really important to keep in mind when you're utilizing the results of this paper and trying to interpret that data. I think the other thing too is, as acute care surgeons in particular, we are often operating on patients in times of extremis or in situations where maybe they're not the, air quotes, best protoplasm, so to speak. And so there's a lot of managing expectations that goes into this, right? We are there to really counsel these patients and ensure that they understand the risks that are associated with that. And they're not sitting there listening to our numbers necessarily. They're not always hearing the 1%, the 5%, the 10%. They're in their mind thinking, is this going to happen to me or is it not? And so I think having a measure like Potter that is more objective and maybe takes away our human error or biases is an important adjunct, but I certainly wouldn't at this point replace the importance of the bedside assessment and the surgeon's decision-making tree as well.
How is the family get involved in the decision-making when you use artificial intelligence in the decision-making?
Yeah, so I think that the patient or the family or the healthcare proxy largely is able to use this data to try to make an informed decision about options for surgery. One of the things that I use it a lot for is whenever I'm counseling a family regarding their need for intervention, is this something that you want to proceed to surgery with, or is this something where you'd rather consider more palliative measures? And so I think when you talk to most patients before they get sick, very few of them want to spend their last minutes surrounded by ICU nurses and physicians. They mostly want to spend time around their family. And so being able to give them an honest assessment about their risks for proceeding with surgery so that they can make an informed decision for whether or not they're going to continue with it is just so incredibly helpful.
Very good.
And I certainly think counseling patients is definitely an art form in a lot of ways, right? Because you'll have those patients that, or the family members that hear, you'll tell them 99% chance of death and 1% chance of survival, and they hear that 1% chance of survival. And so I think it is a difficult process in general. So again, it's just having one more potential tool in your armamentarium when you're looking at the particular patient, the particular family, the particular situation, and figuring out how you can utilize this information to maybe help that particular patient or family member understand the situation.
Very good. Thank you for your time. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas. I'm here at the 2024 Assembly with Dr. Julia Coldman from The Ohio State University. She just finished talking a little bit about papers that should change your practice. And in specific, the paper that she discussed was about pre-hospital TXA. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of just a brief overview of the paper? And then what are your feelings about it? And what is a take-home message, especially given the pretty robust discussion about it?
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to join you and chat about it. So the PATCH trial was an international double-blind placebo-controlled trial of adult trauma patients with suspected severe injuries at risk for trauma-induced coagulopathy. And so patients were randomized, it was blinded, they received 1 gram bolus of TXA and then a 1 gram infusion thereafter. And they looked specifically at survival with a favorable outcome, functional outcome at 6 months defined by their Glasgow outcome scale. And then also looked at some secondary outcomes, including death within 24 hours, 28 days, 6 months, vascular occlusive events, and sepsis within 28 days of injury. It included a little over 1,100 patients, and a fourth of them had lab evidence of coagulopathy. They were severely injured, and they found no difference in their primary outcome of a favorable functional outcome at 6 months. There was improved survival, however, at 24 hours in the TXA patients, but 6 month mortality was not statistically significant. So I think an interesting and important contribution to the literature, some things that were different, the fact that this was pre-hospital and it was 1 gram, previously 2 and 3 grams have been explored. And I think ultimately this adds to the growing body of literature that, for one, supports the use of TXA in patients with biochemical evidence of hyperfibrinolysis and hemorrhagic shock, and the empiric administration of TXA pre-hospital in the right patients. And I think who those patients are is what is to be debated, and also whether it's being given with the intention of its antifibrinolytic effect versus the anti-inflammatory effect that we now know that it has, which is likely what's contributing to improved outcomes in TBI patients. But I think this study at least supports its use in the pre-hospital setting for patients with severe injury at risk for coagulopathy.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We kind of got into a little bit of an existential debate on TXA, if you will, on whether it should be used. Can you talk us through the different questions and different opinions that were sort of brought up around that?
Yeah, so there's always opinions on this topic. That's why I chose it. And so I valiantly stood at the podium knowing that might happen. But one was the question of the dosing, 1 gram versus 2 grams, and whether that would have been different at a higher dose. I think that's hard to know unless you just contextualize it within the literature that shows differences in the 2 and 3 gram dosing. And then, of course, who is the right patient for this? And so some people came up to the mic and said it's really not indicated in patients who are in a urban setting at a level 1 trauma center, that you have short transport times. And I do think there's probably some validity to that, whereas other people said it doesn't matter, rural, urban, or otherwise, people should be getting it. And people should be getting it not necessarily because of its antifibrinolytic effects, but how it's affecting the inflammation cascade and complement specifically and enacting beneficial effects because of that. So I think this whole discussion contributes to the ongoing questions about really is TXA something we should be using therapeutically for its effects on fibrinolysis or on inflammation, both of which are very well married. So I think it's an interesting question in particular in TBI patients too.
Awesome. Well, I'll be looking for more literature to come out on TXA and the continued discussion around it. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Mohamed Bawazir. We just finished a very exciting session about updates in evidence-based care and the most recent EAST PMGs and clinical care pathways. I have here with me Dr. Bhattacharya. He presented his most recent guidelines. Can you please tell us about your guidelines?
Yeah, so our guideline looked at evaluating the role of IVC filters in trauma patients. IVC filters have been available for decades, and their use has evolved with time. And with this PMG, what we were able to elucidate for clinicians at the bedside is that the use of IVC filters in a prophylactic manner is not advisable, and we shouldn't be using them, which is a paradigm shift from what we were doing probably 10, 15 years ago.
Excellent. How many PICO questions in this guidelines?
There were 3 PICO questions. We were able to make recommendations on 2 of them.
Excellent. So what was the first recommendation on the first PICO question?
The first PICO question looked at using IVC filter in a prophylactic fashion in trauma patients who couldn't get a chemo prophylaxis. And our recommendations were that patients should not get prophylactic IVC filters.
Excellent. And what was the second PICO question?
The second question looked at patients who had a known DVT whether they should get an IVC filter if we could not give them chemoprophylaxis. And the data was not really in support of it, so we conditionally recommended against placement of filters in those patients.
Excellent. I have a personal question about this particular case. Do you still put mechanical prophylaxis for these patients' populations or not?
In terms of SCDs and venodiates? Yes, we do. Yes. We still do.
With, knowing the fact that they have DVT?
Yes.
Excellent. Yes. Thank you. And what was the third PICO question?
We looked if there was a role for placing ultra-short duration IVC filters in patients as a stepping bridge till they could receive chemoprophylaxis. But there was no data to analyze to make a recommendation.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. I have here Dr. George Kasitakis. Can you please tell us about your most recent guidelines?
Yes, we looked specifically at whether refixation in elderly patients over the age of 65 with either flail chest or at least 3 place 3 fractures would benefit. After a systematic literature search and review that followed the meta-analysis, we conditionally recommend that refixation takes place in elderly patients with at least 3 displaced 3 fractures. And we also recommend that refixation takes place in elderly patients with flail chest.
Excellent. So in patients with flail chest, why do you recommend?
We recommend refixation in flail chest because it decreases pneumonia rate by about 80%. It decreases the need for intubation by about 50%. And the duration of mechanical ventilation by about 3.5 days in those patients that do end up needing mechanical ventilation. We did not see any difference in pain, hospital length of stay, or mortality in elderly patients with flail chest that did have refixation. In terms of the patient that had the at least 3 displaced 3 fractures, those that underwent fixation, we noticed that their pain levels was about 1.5 point lower for the first 2 weeks. There was no difference in pain beyond that point. So the pain at 4, 6, and 12 weeks was no different whether patients received refixation versus not. However, there was a significant improvement in mortality in patients that did undergo the refixation.
It's really exciting. I hope these guidelines will be accepted for publication in the very near future. We noticed also that you have a new product of the evidence base. It's the clinical care pathways. Can you please introduce the new product for us?
Yes, of course. We're very excited to introduce the clinical care pathways. As we discussed earlier in the presentation, we have been utilizing the GRADE methodology for the past decade or so, and it's worked great so far. However, the guidelines that we have been producing up until now have typically relied on recommendation of one versus another intervention. And frequently, we can make no recommendations whatsoever because there's simply no evidence to suggest that one is better than the other or vice versa. Of course, real life does not work like that. Many times, every time actually, we have to give an answer and a way forward in any patients, whether we have data versus not. Now, we also know that there are several other societies that have come up with a variety of clinical algorithms. However, those are commonly based on incomplete literature reviews. There's no standardized or transparent and reproducible methodology on how those are done. And of course, expert opinion and author team biases weigh heavily on how those are done. So we at EAST decided to address this gap in evidence-based medicine and develop clinical algorithms that tackle clinical conditions from their diagnosis to resolution. And by utilizing the SMART methodology, we are developing algorithms that are completely evidence-based, completely transparent. They are systematic, they are completely reproducible, and they are efficient. And today we just introduced the first two on the management of pneumothorax after trauma and management of the pregnant trauma patient.
That's really exciting. I hope we'll be seeing more and more of these clinical care pathways in the future.
Absolutely. And we're looking forward to making them available at EAST.org.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
You as well.
I have here Dr. Kartiko, who presented the first clinical care pathway about the management of hemothorax, and Dr. Elizabeth Turner, who presented the first clinical care pathway about the management of trauma in pregnancy. Dr. Kartiko, can you please summarize the clinical care pathway that you just presented today?
So the clinical care pathway for traumatic hemothorax are designed so that we have an algorithmic way of approaching the disease. And so we went through the amount of traumatic hemothorax that we should do an intervention on, which is 300 cc. We looked into a modality of imaging, and we found that CT scan is the highest yield for imaging, although chest x-ray can also be used, especially once the intervention is already done. We also looked into the size of the chest tube that we should be using, and we found that the pigtail chest tube is as good in a sense with a similar amount of complication or results. Then large bore chest tube, so pigtail is what we recommend. We also looked into the management of retained hemothorax, in which we recommend for a CT scan, and if there is more than 300 cc of retained hemothorax, we recommend for intervention. And the intervention that we recommend is early vets, less than 4 days is recommended, although thrombolytic therapy can also be done if the patient is not a good surgical candidate.
Perfect. Dr. Turner, can you please summarize the clinical care pathway about trauma in pregnancy?
Okay, so we divided trauma in pregnancy into blunt versus penetrating, looking at when to consider imaging, how to interpret your FAST, how to work with obstetrics for the blunt injury, and then for penetrating, when to consider wound exploration versus diagnostic laparoscopy versus exploratory laparotomy, and when to evaluate with FAST, and how to interpret the information that you do have for best management and care of the fetus and the mom.
Perfect. I'm really looking forward to see these clinical care pathways get published, and we can have access to them in the website. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa Warte, and I'm with Dr. Melissa Boltz, who just gave us a great part taste patient in the session, acute care surgery, how much is too much? And without further ado, I'll let her introduce herself and a little bit about herself.
Hello, I'm Melissa Boltz. I'm an associate professor of surgery at Penn State Health, Hershey Medical Center, and I'm also the vice chair of quality and patient safety, as well as the director of the Emergency General Surgery Service Line. And we first got interested in this topic on the East Quality Safety and Outcomes Committee after listening to Pat Murphy's podcast as a full-time equivalent, and we thought this would make a really great presentation at East. And so we kind of got talking with Pat and asked if he would do a session with us, and then talked to our team members within the quality committee and really tried to branch out and sort of define what does an FTE look like for the acute care surgeon and how to implement a staffing model, looking at how we can improve our well-being as well as patient safety and quality of care.
Right. And I think those are all really important and key topics for all of us today as we wear a lot more hats, not just trauma surgeons, but acute care surgeon, critical care, often doing the lion's share of the quality work for the hospitals and patient safety and all of those lovely patient safety indicators and indices. So when you are taking a look at your staffing model and trying to figure out what's going to work for your institution, do you have any key points that people should think about as they go into this process?
So I think the first thing is to determine what are all the things you cover as the acute care surgeon in the hospital, not just trauma and emergency general surgery and surgical critical care, but all the other things you get called about, whether it be doing an emergent crike or this patient needs an emergent consultation to rule out necrotizing soft tissue infection. Any sort of emergencies, do you respond to AAA alerts in the emergency department? All those things are points to consider. And what is the manpower that is needed to do those tasks in the leanest but safest way? And then sort of build on that. It's helpful to talk to folks across the country. That's what we did at our institution. Then really get everyone in the division to take part in developing the structure, then you have the most buy-in and you can build upon that. The other point to consider is really defining what is your work week at Penn State Hershey. We define it as 55 hours, and that was clinical and non-clinical hours. So really that equates to about 47 clinical hours per week and 8 non-clinical hours per week. And so we thought that it was a nice balance. But it's going to be different for every institution. And so I think the key is just to get all the stakeholders involved to have that initial discussion.
That's really great advice. And I think, as you mentioned, and I believe Pat Murphy also mentioned, every place is a little different. So figuring out your needs and how you're going to accomplish that is always a little different, but that we're still the firehouse model and there's always got to be somebody there. With that, I thank you again for a great session and your words of wisdom, and have a great rest of your time at East.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to our segment on different panel sessions. I am Samantha Terrace, acute care surgeon at Indiana University. And one of the later afternoon sessions on Wednesday was about expanding your trauma team's influence by incorporating exceptional APPs in clinical research and administrative roles. In this session, there were three extraordinary APPs that discussed varying topics. I'm here with Anika Kay, and I will let her introduce herself. She talked about her role in the research realm with APPs. I'll let her go into a little bit, but first, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Samantha, for the opportunity. So I'm Anika Kay. I'm a PA at Intermountain Medical Center with Intermountain Health in Salt Lake City, Utah. I've been a PA since 2010. I completed a APP fellowship program in trauma critical care at Intermountain and have been hired on working there full-time ever since.
Tell me a little bit about what you discussed at the session.
What makes my story a little bit unique is my involvement in clinical research and quality improvement. I really attribute that to the APP fellowship program that I was lucky to complete, which really served as the launching pad and the platform for my interest in research. There was a required research project for that program and was able to present that as an oral podium presentation. That was my first peer-reviewed publication over a decade ago, and that kind of launched my career. I obviously had a keen interest in research and asking questions and writing papers, and was very fortunate in timing to be paired up with a surgeon who came to our program to really grow the research department. We're a level one trauma center, but a non-academic institution. I was able to partner with her, a shared vision of what I could do and the value that I could add to our program. And over the last 13 years, we've really kept our institution alive with our level one verification. We've really elevated the kind of culture and research mindset, I think, is applicable to all APPs that can practice at the top of their scope. You know, many ways in which APPs can go above and beyond the day-to-day clinical care, which is, of course, extremely important, but just an example of how we can contribute beyond that to really add to our value.
Excellent. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with your surgeon and how do you guys help develop this program.
I was lucky to walk onto a well-oiled machine. Our program was a realized vision of one of our trauma surgeons in the late 90s. I would say it has to begin with a collegial working relationship with our surgeons, kind of that shared vision of what we can do clinically, what we can do on and off the court, if you will. I think that's really important to try to cultivate at your institution. It's important that more APPs and more surgeons are aware of what we can contribute, but I think that relationship is really important. And I think having the quote privilege of the podium at many national meetings has helped cultivate that relationship between APPs and physicians.
So this sounds such like a great idea, having APPs involved in these types of projects, but how do you get the funding for this? How do you convince your administration that these people are going to be doing research in some of their working hours?
So I would say that a great place to start would be quality. I think that in terms of the sell to the institution, the quality improvement projects is a great place to begin. I think every team, every service, every institution has room for quality improvement, and there's ROI arguments are part of that. If you improve quality, if you reduce excess utilization of resources, reduce hospital readmissions, shorten length of stay, et cetera, that's a great place, you know, to go. Quality projects are an excellent place for APPs to look and to kind of begin that, cultivating and developing that role.
And what influence does this type of program have on your guys' retention?
Oh, it's huge. I've been there for 13 years and I'm like the little one still. So I think our retention is very high. I think when APPs come to our service and they see what we do clinically and the autonomy that we have and the respect and the trust which we've established with our surgeons, I think that's number one, right? And then I think you see APPs on our service are involved in EMS outreach with protected time. I'm involved in research. There are APPs involved in PI. So I think having APPs on a service who not only are optimized clinically, but also off the court is really important.
Thank you so much. This was a great conversation, and hopefully this helps others get more APP support and incorporation into their teams at their own institution. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and the platform. I appreciate it.
Continuing our discussion from the panel regarding expanded roles of APPs on services, I'm here with another APP, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Colleen Trevino. I am a nurse practitioner with the Division of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. I've been there for almost 22 years, and my role there is the Director of Advanced Practice, and I have a faculty appointment, so I do some research as well. I was asked to be part of the panel to discuss program development in trauma and acute care surgery. I just gave some information about how we put together our trauma quality of life clinic for our gun violence survivors. It was a process of how to get it up and running and how to get administration to support the program. The key, of course, is always that a physician APP partnership and mutual respect and trust that really helped it move forward. I think the program itself, when you're building it, administration wants to know the dollar signs and how the hospital and or practice is going to benefit. But what we were able to do is show that we could still have a billable opportunity while improving the care and access for our patients who are really at high risk for poor quality of life after firearm injury. So what we were able to do is tell the stories of our patients. And I think we have some really amazing stories. Everybody does, every week, every month, every year. And we have to be able to articulate those to people who really are focused on the dollars, because they are usually not clinicians and don't understand the impact that we have in our communities and for our patients and their families. So being able to explain what we do, we all know the things that we do on a day-to-day basis when we're sitting at the bedside or you're in the operating room or in the trauma bay, but to get to be able to tell the stories of how we save lives and send people back out while they may have not died from their injuries, they're really suffering. And it's our obligation to ensure that we can get them home and back to their baseline as close as possible, and maybe even better. So having those partnerships and understanding on how to put together a business model is really important for program development. And APPs are completely appropriate for managing specialty populations that are going to need more of a long-term longitudinal management strategy, especially for academic medical centers where you have residents and fellows. They kind of come and go, but the APPs and the surgeons are there all the time. Having that core group of people that can manage patients longitudinally is really an opportunity for APPs across trauma care. So we put together a multidisciplinary clinic for our firearm injury survivors, and I run it. I'm the director of the program. I manage all of the people that are associated with it, and it's multidisciplinary. So we have a physical therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, and our people who are hospital-based violence interrupters. We put that together. We're actually going on our third year. I think we've seen about 600 patients throughout, and it's super satisfying. Back in the day, I wouldn't ask the questions of, are you sleeping? Are you having any anxiety? Are you having flashbacks? Because I wouldn't have any way to address it. But now I can ask all the questions. How are you doing overall? What is your biggest concern? And they can say, I don't have food, and I'll be okay. Well, I'll have the social worker come and talk to you. Or I can't get to my appointments because I don't have any transportation. okay, well, I can help you with that. Or I don't want to go back home because I'm not safe there. I was injured in my home. And then I can talk to our 4-on-4 life interventionist. So it's very satisfying and you can really help the whole person. We also have a enteric fistula service that we provide. So we do consults inpatient. We have referrals throughout the whole state. So people will be referred whether they're inpatient or outpatient. We get the consult. We do the consult whether they're inpatient or outpatient. We manage their nutrition, their wounds, controlling the outputs. We have a whole protocol. And then when, and most of the patients go home, so we're able to set all of that up, even for our high output fistulas at home. And then when it's the 6 to 12 months and it's time for surgery, that's when we bring our surgeons in. It's just very collaborative and we're able to just manage the patients. It's once again another kind of resource intensive patient population. Having our APE focus on that and then the surgeons focus on the operation ultimately is just the right provider for the right timing for the surgery.
Excellent. Clearly you guys are doing a lot of great like outpatient work. How did you end up getting into a little bit of the outpatient world and developing these multidisciplinary clinics? They do involve a lot of people getting a lot of buy-in from many different specialties. I think most of us as surgeons, you don't really have to sell anything to us because we're like, oh yeah, the patient needs great nutrition. That we know they need these like resources for home and all this stuff. So how do you convince to get this space and this clinic up and running so that the patients can get this care and kind of progress and then hopefully not be coming back as patients in the emergency room or especially the EC fistula is like coming back with dehydration or other things that, you know, that if you had just known about these things ahead of time, could manage them before coming to the emergency room.
It was just two of us 20 years ago when we started the fistula program. Actually, that it's probably been going on for about 15 years, organized. Before that, it was a disaster. And it was one person who had a gallbladder go bad, and she was in the hospital for 364 days, had more than 50 operations, because we didn't know really how to manage. We'd just keep taking her back and hoping that it could be fixed. So she was the impetus to develop this program. So with that, we were like, we can't do this. We know we're going to have these patients. And these patients need somebody who knows what they're doing. And so that's how we put it together. So it was more incremental. And so we did all the outpatient, inpatient. So we, our APPs back and forth. And so to get the space for outpatient care, it was already there. But how do you get the extra resources in the clinic? And that is really about talking about readmissions, talking about ED visits to administration and say, if you give me this space in the clinic and a nurse that could put an IV in and they don't have to go to the end and get some fluids, then you won't be clogging up our ED with these patients. And so it, once again, it's the stories and mixed with the data. But you gotta be able to get in front of those people that can make those decisions or allow you to be able to develop it. And that's, I think, really where our physician APP partnership comes in. If you look like you are your partners and like you were really developed team and you have mutual respect for each other, people see that and it really lifts up APP practice and helps you move forward with developing those kind of programs.
I'm pretty sure we could probably talk for hours about all the things that you guys do for us for surgery, but thank you so much for coming today and giving the brief synopsis of what you presented, and hopefully this will spur other ideas in other places too. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer. And make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.